This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We last spoke about Charlotte's rising homicide rate on March 29th. At that time, the city had experienced 21 homicides in 2017. Today, 10 weeks later, that number stands at 38. That's 17 murders in 10 weeks. Crime rates started rising last year in the nation's major metropolitan areas and seem to be on track to increase again this year. At the same time, murder rates also began to rise, but the increase seemed confined to just 10 cities. Is Charlotte part of this trend?
We are seeing way too much disregard for human life. People are settling their disputes with the use of a firearm, and the result is never going to be good. And that's what's concerning with us as a police department, that there has to be some sort of way that we need to look at, and how do we stop these disputes or these things from happening that are going to end in the death of someone else, particularly by the use of a firearm.
Deputy Chief Johnny Jennings, CMPD, says they are doing what they can to combat the problem. So what impact are those efforts having? We spend the hour talking about that with Daryl Stevens, former CMPD chief and now executive director of the Major Cities Chiefs Association. Welcome back to the program.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
Nice to have you here. He's in our Spirit Square studio. With us by phone is Dr. Michael Turner, professor and chair of the Department of Criminal Justice and Criminology at UNC Charlotte. Thank you for coming back. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, Mike.
Well, when we last spoke about this issue, people were hesitant to use the word trend in reference to the rising homicide rate in Charlotte. Daryl Stevens, you were quoted in Time in January as saying it's too early to know whether increases seen over the last 2 years are mere blips or the beginning of a sustained increase in overall crime rates around the country. But when it comes to murder rates and to Charlotte, can we now call this a trend?
Well, I think it's approaching a time where we certainly can. Nationally, there's a significant number of large cities over the past 2 years that have had increases in homicides and other violent crime. That trend continues the first quarter of this year. There's about 30 or 35 cities that have continued to report increases. Half a dozen are much more than others, but I would begin to be worried that we're seeing a trend here that nobody is going to be pleased with.
Michael Turner, same question, because you study statistics all over the country. Would you consider this to be a trend in Charlotte?
I would say it's the beginning of a trend. I would not conclude yet that we are at a trend. I think even the FBI warns not to use the UCR data from year to year, looking at a 1 or 2 year blip as a trend. I think when you get in the 3-4 year period, I think that's when you probably can confirm that there's some things going on that appear to be a little bit more concerning than things in the past.
I was going to ask you the question this morning, Daryl Stevens, about whether or not this is these murders are being committed primarily by people who know each other, or are these random acts of violence? And yet in the paper this morning, it reports that people fundamentally know each other, that they're involved in some way, that are involved in these incidents. That's the norm, isn't it?
That is the norm. That's been the case for many, many years. People are most afraid of the stranger homicide, the attack by people that you don't know. But most of these encounters are with acquaintances, friends, people that are meeting for one reason or another, and their encounter just goes awry for some reason.
And that's the case around the country, right, Dr. Turner?
I believe that's the case. I would listen to what the officers have to say on the front line. They have the best perspective to know the most about the crime and the incidents and the events that kind of led up to that. So if that's what the officers are saying, as the deputy chief mentioned that early on the show, I would believe those folks first.
Okay. So as we talk about this, whenever the media talks about crime rates or murder rates and the rise in the murder rate, people immediately begin to fear that they have to look over their shoulder wherever they go. And what you're telling us, Daryl Stevens, is that you may have to do that if you're in a certain line of work or if you are in a certain area or you've been involved in certain activities. But the average person doesn't have to worry about this?
Average person that has normal lifestyles, not involved in high-risk kinds of activities. They're not substance abuse, involved in substance abuse or going to places to buy those drugs. Their likelihood of being killed is very, very small. And the likelihood of the person killing them is going to be a friend or a relative or a family member.
So who are these people and what kinds of activities are they involved in Charlotte in terms of who are the murderers and who are the victims?
Well, in Charlotte, I'm not as familiar with the current situation in terms of what's taking place right now. But historically, in Charlotte and most other urban areas, the biggest proportion of victims are African-American males who are 16 to 35. The biggest proportion of people responsible for the killings are African-American males in that 16 to 35 range. In both cases, both victims and suspects, they have violent lifestyles. They have criminal records. They've been engaged with the criminal justice system off and on throughout their life. And so they find themselves in a situation where even coming out of prison, we don't have the services that we need to help them make the transition. So they go back to doing the same things that they were doing before. And the way they settle arguments is with violence. Guns, very prevalent. That's the tool that they use, and that's what's mostly used in homicides throughout America.
Why? What leads to that attitude, Michael Turner? Why is it mostly African-American on African-American? Why are they the ones that are usually solving problems or disputes by pointing a gun at somebody and then ultimately pulling the trigger? What leads to that?
I think there's a variety of things that might contribute to that. But let me just add one other thing to Daryl's comment. And I agree with him, everything that he said 100%. But the one thing that I do want to add is those murders, offenders and victims, tend to be in very concentrated areas. So as he said, and he correctly pointed out, I believe that the average citizen does not have an issue or a concern or a high probability of being a murder victim. But there are areas of the city within cities that have very high likelihoods of being individuals in those cities have very high likelihoods of being a victim and an offender of a homicide. So you ask yourself, common question is what is going on in those areas of the city that tend to be high concentrated or hot spots of activity? And you know, I see a murder as a successful aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, and why those individuals are choosing to use deadly weapons to solve disputes, I think it probably varies across the individual. But access to those firearms is one thing. I mean, I think if you were to limit access to firearms, and several cities have tried to do this, then you will or hopefully should see a reduction in the homicide rates. But there are a lot of other contributors. People are frustrated in the society that they live in, frustrated in the areas of society that they live in, the areas, the neighborhoods that they live in. They don't see a way out, and they often solve problems using firearms. And so I think it's a lot of things contributing to that.
So as Michael Turner points out, Daryl Stevens, these neighborhoods, there can be areas in cities where these murders occur most frequently, almost all the time, and there are areas of the cities of these cities where murders occur, where no murders occur in these particular neighborhoods. So that means that these neighborhoods where these murders occur are predictable, are they not?
They are indeed.
So they hold in common high poverty, not just the fact that it's African American, but just it's high poverty. Correct?
That's you're absolutely right. It is predictable the locations that they'll take place, that where these crimes will take place. In fact, some of what is now being called predictive policing is based on looking at trends over long periods of time. And you can see a fairly clear picture where these take place. If you look at it nationally, 68% of the murders that occur, they occur in 5% of the counties. So it's really a small part of our country, small part of our communities where homicide and other violent crime is concentrated.
You mentioned predictive policing, and we certainly don't want to discourage that because obviously that plays a role in preventing at least some of these. But are we getting enough social services into those neighborhoods, enough other types of help into those neighborhoods that might short-circuit this long before it ever happens?
In my opinion, no. You look at all the demographics of people involved in violent crime, not just the criminal history record, but a good number of them had not been successful in the educational system. High unemployment is concentrated in these areas, and so you don't have opportunities to explore and live a life that doesn't put you on the street and engaged in activities that's going to increase your potential to encounter someone in a violent manner.
And you report that The Economist, a publication, puts Charlotte into a category of cities described as low and stable for homicides.
That's correct. That doesn't include data from 2017. They looked at 2016 data, and Charlotte is like there's 10 or 12 cities in that category that they categorized as low and stable in the homicide rates. Places like New York and Los Angeles and San Jose and Austin and those. I was a little surprised to see that when I encountered that because of what's happened the past 2 years. But before that, Charlotte's homicides have gone way down since the time that I was the police chief. They've dropped significantly, and it's only in the past couple of years where we've seen them tick back up.
So we know that in Charlotte, at least, that certain neighborhoods are more prone to this kind of violent activity, and I think it's the same across the country, the same kinds of neighborhoods, the same situations existing in places across the country. So, Dr. Turner, why aren't we focusing more attention on these neighborhoods in terms not just of policing and preventative policing, but in terms of trying to keep kids in school and do other things that might be more helpful?
Well, that's probably a much more deeper political conversation. But again, if you look at the area between the 3 mile band on 85 between Route 16 and up to West Sugar Creek, if you look at the plotting of the events that occurred, that's probably about 1/3 of the homicides occur in that band in the city of Charlotte. Now, so the question really is, what's going on within those bands and what can we do about crime and particularly murder in those bands? And again, it goes back to the schools, it goes back to opportunities, it goes back to things that a lot of people, again, politically see this view or see this issue on two completely different spectrums. Some individuals believe that those individuals have enough services that can help and provide education or valid or good educational opportunities for individuals to thrive and be a productive citizen. Other individuals think that we don't have enough. So that's the political struggle that you see and where the resources are distributed that probably causes a larger concern on how to deal with those.
We heard early in the program a recording of Deputy Chief Johnny Jennings from CMPD, who went on to say that we're going to start looking at victimization and control and how do we keep these things from occurring in the first place. They're going to look at that and take a deeper dive as a police department. And he says we want other people to join us in that and make sure that it's not just falling on the police department when these things happen. That's the police department talking. Is anybody listening?
It's hard to get people to listen in dealing with this problem. If it doesn't affect you personally, you're not in one of those neighborhoods, you don't have a relative, then you're not going to focus on it.
We have to stop. We're coming right back with more. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Gardner-Webb University, a private Christian liberal arts experience dedicated to preparing students for success. Now accepting summer and fall applications at gardner-webb.edu. And the Isiola Lodge at Linville Golf Club, featuring local fresh cuisine at Donald Ross Championship Golf Course and Spa, located off the Blue Ridge Parkway. Information at isiola.com. Tomorrow, 1 month after his controversial firing, former FBI Director James Comey is scheduled to testify before the Senate Intelligence Committee to give his side of the story in the investigation of Russia's involvement in last year's election and what members of the Trump campaign may have known about it. A look at the politics of that and recent court decisions about race and politics in North Carolina, both tomorrow at 9.
I'm Anthony Brooks. Coming up on the next On Point, getting ready for Jim Comey's congressional testimony. We'll look at the key players, the unanswered questions about Russia, and what's at stake. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
You can join On Point coming up at 10 right after Charlotte Talks. Here on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Daryl Stevens, Executive Director of the Major Cities Chiefs Association and former Chief of CMPD, about the rising homicide rate in Charlotte. Also with us by phone, Dr. Michael Turner, Professor and Chair of the Department of Criminal Justice and Criminology at UNC Charlotte. You can join our conversation by emailing us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, getting to us through Facebook or Twitter at Charlotte Talks, and you can watch us this morning on Facebook Live. One of the things, Dr. Turner, that you cautioned when we talked about this problem back in March was that it's important to place violence statistics in their proper social context. So when you do that, what do you learn?
Well, it's not only social context, but temporal context as well. And like I said earlier, is that, you know, we are at one of our most safest periods of our adult lives. And even though there is an uptick, and by the way, I mean, if you look back at the data in 2008, just as recently as 2008, Charlotte had 83 homicides. So we're still short of that, and we're still well below the height that we've seen in the 90s and actually in the early 80s. And actually, if you look at the statistics, you know, in Charlotte specifically, I mean, we're safer than we've been since the early 1960s. So when I think about, you know, the growth that we're having or the uptick that we're having, it's kind of like a very obese person who lost 150 pounds but now has gained 10 or 15 pounds back. Is it a reason to be majorly concerned? Probably not yet, but, you know, you want to get a handle on that growth. And that's the hard thing. I mean, we can't look to the police, and you left off before the break. We can't look to the police to be the only individuals who sees that or are fighting that uptick in the murder rate.
But he just mentioned, Daryl Stevens, that in the 90s we had a much higher rate than we have today. What caused the rate to go down? What is causing it to rise? What's happening in the zeitgeist?
That's the key question, and the one that lacks a lot of our ability to explain. We think that what's causing the contributing to the increase right now, and what's similar to what we saw in the 80s and early 90s, is substance abuse. Opioid is a major epidemic and crisis for us in this country. The numbers are just now coming out, but 59,000 people died in America from opioid overdoses last year, and that's almost a 20% increase over the year before. Police chiefs, when they talk about the homicide increases and the violence, that's part of the picture. That's part of what's contributing to the conflict and over the drug markets and the encounters and people's ability to sell and buy drugs. One of the other things that you hear quite frequently is the impact of social media today. Mm-hmm. Social media is where it's not just a conflict that we have when we come together. I insult somebody on my Facebook or Twitter on my tweet, and then they lash out and come back. And we're seeing a lot of violence amongst young people that's generated by that kind of conflict.
You're the head of the Major Cities Chiefs Association, and you supplied us with some survey totals on violent crime. And I'm just going to read a few of these because I don't know how many cities this includes, but it's pages of information. Atlanta police this year so far, this is the first 3 months of 2017, 17 homicides. That's down from this time last year. Boston police, 6 homicides, down from last year. Cleveland police, 32, up from last year and still lower than our rate. Columbus police, 30 homicides, up from last year, still lower than ours. DeKalb County, which is outside of Atlanta or part of Atlanta, 14 homicides, down from last year. The Denver police, 10 homicides, up from last year, but way lower than ours. Indianapolis, 20, down from last year. And we're up 38.
Right. That's a question that's very difficult to answer. Why is Charlotte different than some of those other cities? If you look at two cities, for example, Tulsa and Oklahoma City, both of their numbers are up pretty significantly this year. On that chart that you have, Oklahoma City, it's only 1 month's data. They didn't have the other two, and so they've had 10 in that first month versus a two before.
But then you look at Prince George's County, which is a D.C. suburb, and when you look at the suburbs of D.C., you have Prince George's County, Maryland, Montgomery County, Maryland.
Right.
Economically very different. Montgomery County is much higher level. You have Fairfax County in Virginia, which is one of the highest per capita incomes in the country. Yet in Prince George's County, only 22 homicides this year.
Right, and it is a community whose poverty levels are much higher than anything else around. But probably their socioeconomic conditions are better than many of the urban areas of large cities like Charlotte and Milwaukee and Chicago.
Because
and
it's the nation's capital and employment's relatively stable in the nation's capital?
It is indeed.
Okay. MCCA, your organization, says that winter is generally a lower time for homicides, and yet our homicide rate for the first quarter of this year is up. So what does that tell you? What might it mean for the summer months ahead?
Well, that's one of the reasons that I believe that as we go through the rest of the year that we're going to see a continued increase in the violence. It won't be that way in all the cities, but I think by the time we get to the end of this year, we're going to find ourselves in a similar situation that we were at the end of 2016, with probably 35 or 40 cities that have seen a continued increase in violent crime.
I want to come back, Michael Turner, to something you said a moment ago, and that America is actually safer today than it was just a few decades ago. And I think it's important to say that and to underline that, because when you have conversations like these that people come into and out of because it's on the radio, they could leave this conversation being very fearful about what's going on. But given the rising crime rate and the rising homicide rate, not only here but in major cities around the country, can it still be said that we're safer than we have been in decades?
I absolutely think it could still be said. And again, it's something that we talked about earlier, is when you look at violence and you look at your risk of violence as being a victim, that risk is not equal across the city. So I think, you know, we are safer. I think there are only two homicides in Charlotte that occurred relatively near the uptown area. So most individuals are not going into the areas where the homicides are occurring. It's not where people travel in and out of. So those are taking place. Those homicides are taking place with individuals within those areas who live there, who are solving problems via a firearm, typically. And oftentimes, again, I just spoke with a crime analyst from CMPD yesterday, and he was instructive, and I agree with him, and say that if we really want to lower the crime rate, the murder rate, you got to go after the assault with a deadly weapon rate and have or figure out ways in which you can get people to stop solving problems via assaults with a deadly weapon. And that's going to be where you're going to see the change. So, yeah, we are a safer society. The violence, as Daryl pointed out, five counties account for 2/3 of the murder rate. Most of us don't live in those five counties. So in the aggregate, Mike, I think we are a much safer society.
From the police's point of view, there are probably as many reasons that this occurs as there are people on the planet. But how would you rank all these different possible factors? The availability of guns, the easy availability of guns, a feeling of anger driven by, bleak economic conditions and no hope for getting out of them, a desire for respect, and the expectation that disrespect requires a response, a loss of appreciation for human life, and other factors. How would you rank them in terms of what drives all this?
I would rank the overwhelming presence of firearms as being a key factor that makes us as a country different than any other country in the world, any civilized country in the world or industrialized country in the world, and a continuation of policies that doesn't regulate the firearm possession. In fact, we're continuing to march down a path of deregulation. Yeah. North Carolina's considering doing away with any requirements for carrying a concealed weapon. So just anyone can do that without a permit, without any kind of training. And the more of those weapons that are on the street doesn't necessarily mean that individuals that aren't engaged in this lifestyle are going to kill more people. But the availability of those guns to be stolen, the availability of those guns that in such huge numbers, I think puts us in a position where that's the instruments that you use. 65-70% of the homicides in America. There's violence in Canada. There's violence in Britain. There's violence in other parts of the world. The difference is that they don't have the firearms.
Because of the Second Amendment, we all have a right to have a gun. And gun advocates continually say that I feel safer having access to a firearm because if something happens around me, I can respond to that person. And that in situations where things have happened, where guns have been discharged among crowds of people, if only those other people had had a gun, it would have stopped sooner. And they may have a point to that. But does that send a message to people that it's okay to solve problems by carrying a gun?
I think it does help make some people feel safer. The challenge that they have is when you get into these heated exchanges, encounters with people, and maybe turn to violence, that the fact that weapon's so readily available to you then turns into something that's much more serious than the risk of you punching me or me punching you. You're a little more distance and you feel safer. I think there's nothing wrong with people having guns, but there's also nothing wrong with reasonable, thoughtful policy in how we handle and manage those firearms.
How do you make that happen in light of the Second Amendment?
Well, the Second Amendment is, you know, clearly allows you to own and possess guns. Second Amendment, or years and years of legal battles and decisions, has said that government can regulate firearms. You can require licenses. You can require permits. You can require registration of a firearm if you wanted to do that. We've just convinced ourselves with the political rhetoric over the years that this is an area that government doesn't need to be involved in at all, and I couldn't disagree with that more.
Okay. Beth emails, as a teacher, I am concerned about violence, both at school and among school-aged kids. What is being done in schools to prevent violence? I'm not sure either of our panelists here can answer that question. Do you know?
To some extent, what schools have historically done, and to some extent it's been kind of a problem, is try to isolate the people who have the tendency to engage in violence in the school setting. So they create special schools. Special schools, a better approach than suspension. Suspension numbers have gone down because of some emphasis over the past few years. But you have a child that gets himself in trouble and has a tendency towards violence. Maybe teachers are afraid, so they kick him out of school. And that's a dead end. That goes nowhere. And so what a lot of them do, they try to isolate them. There's a lot of schools that have begun to go back to teaching conflict management, mm-hmm. how to resolve conflicts.
Dr. Turner, uniform crime reporting statistics indicate that the homicide rate increased in 2016 for the second year in a row. That's last year. But you point out that in that first year, the years before 2016, 2014, 2015, it climbed at a 10 to 11% increase, a number which you say is deceiving because the base rate is so low. Explain that.
Well, think of it this way. If there were 10 homicides in a city and you increase by 5, okay, now you have a 50% increase. However, if you have 100 homicides and you increase by 5, that's a much smaller increase, 5% increase. So when the base rates get so low as they are now, when they're in the low or the mid fours or the low fives, any increase in homicide rates appears to be a pretty high increase because the base rates are so low. So when the base rates were higher in the 90s and you had a small change or a relatively small change in the base rates, in the subsequent year, it didn't have as large of an effect because the base rates were much higher.
So percentages can be deceiving, which we've heard many times in the past. Can that be said about Charlotte? How do you look at 38 homicides in the first 6 months of the year compared with previous years or with previous high homicide rates in Charlotte?
Yeah, like I said, I agree with Darrell. I think it's something that we need to pay attention to. I don't think it's a trend just yet, but it's something that we need to pay attention. I think officers are paying attention, law enforcement is paying attention to. We need to have larger discussions about how we can address that and not leave it to law enforcement to on their own to address it. I've seen estimates that we'll be in the 80s this year. Again, we were in the 80s as recently as 2008, and I don't recall at that time that there being a concern that homicide rates were, jumping up to places where we couldn't manage them or we were concerned about. Because we did have a little bit of an uptick in, I think it was 05 and 06, somewhere in that area. But not as high as we're having now. So this might be, again, it might be the beginning of a larger trend. I think you just got to wait and see. We don't collect data and share data like the Department of Labor on the number of jobs and unemployment rates on a month-to-month basis, okay? The 16 results, the 2016 statistics, haven't even been released yet formally until late August, early September. So we're always about a year and a half behind in understanding what's truly going on. So that's part of the problem.
Was going to be my next question, because you point out that the 2016 Uniform Crime Reporting Statistics will be released in August or September of this year. That's 18 months or 19 months after the end of the beginning of 2016. Why? We live in an age of big data with computers gathering information and chugging them out all the time. Why does it take so long to get crime statistics?
Yeah, it's only 9 months since the end of the year.
Even so.
There's a lot of cleaning up of the data and things of those sorts. Cleaning up of the data, understanding the estimates, the population estimates, which go into the denominator. So all of those things need to be cleaned up and prepared and subsequently disseminated. But, we're not, it's a question I ask as well. If we're so concerned about this, we should have a better mechanism to report either on a monthly basis like we do with the labor market. As you see, every month we get an estimate of the number of new jobs that have been developed. We don't see that with crime. Crime is something that we don't prioritize like we do in jobs and the unemployment rate.
Yeah, part of the
I have no explanation for that.
Yeah, part of the challenge that they have is these data come from 50 states.
Right.
They have to go through their process, and once they get through their process and they're comfortable with the numbers, it takes several months to do that.
And each of those states is different in the way they process numbers.
They are. And but I think the fundamental question is why can't we have national estimates and national data? We can. We haven't the resources aren't there to do that.
I have 30 seconds. What would the impact of that be if we did have that ability?
I think the impact of that would be that we would have a much better, much clearer understanding of the ongoing challenges that we have. That's why the data that you talked about earlier, we collect that because it gives us some insight into what's happened in the major cities.
Right. Darrell Stevens is a former CMPD chief. He's the executive director of the Major Cities Chiefs Association. Dr. Michael Turner is professor and chair of the Department of Criminal Justice and Criminology at UNC Charlotte. When we come back, we'll talk to somebody directly impacted by murder. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Corkscrew Wine Shop and Bar, located at Burkdale Village in Lake Norman, offering wines from around the world, live local music, and craft beer on tap. Relax, uncork, unwind. The Corkscrew, details at thescrewcrew.com. And Doctors Making House Calls, physician-owned and managed, Doctors Making House Calls works to help complex patients stay healthy at home and avoid unnecessary ER visits and hospitalizations. Details available at doctorsmakinghousecalls.com. All eyes will be on the Senate Intelligence Committee tomorrow for the testimony of fired FBI Director James Comey. So far, we've heard that President Trump's version of it, we've heard the president's version of events. Now it's Comey's turn, and they'll take a look at the key players, the remaining questions about the Russia probe and what's at stake tomorrow during On Point in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock with guest host Anthony Brooks. We will continue our conversation, and you can reach us at charlottetalks at wfae.org or through Twitter at charlottetalks or watch us on Facebook Live.
High on a remote mountain, climber Emily Harrington could see her goal, the summit, but getting there would be tough.
Climbing from here is going to be more technical, more dangerous. It's going to be harder than anything that we've done up until this point.
I'm Kelly McEvers. Our series on learning from failure concludes in the mountains of Southeast Asia this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Daryl Stevens and Dr. Michael Turner remain with us, but murder is more than a statistic. It's a tragedy, and it involves the loss of a human life, a loved one, a brother, a sister, a father, a mother, a son, a daughter. No one knows that better than Judy Williams. She is the co-founder of Mothers of Murdered Offspring here in Charlotte, and she joins us now by phone. Thank you for being here, Judy. Good morning. For those who have not been touched by the murder of someone close to them, this is by and large, in fact, merely a statistic. When did it stop being one for you?
It happened in 1993 when my goddaughter was murdered. Her name is Shauna Hawk. Shauna was murdered by a serial killer, Henry Louis Wallace. And at that point, it just takes you so by surprise. Because this happens to other people. It doesn't happen to you. Mm-hmm. It doesn't happen to your family. It doesn't happen to anybody you know. So, you know, you just go like, what? What do you do with this pain? What do you do with the tears? What do you do with the sadness? And what we chose to do was to reach back out to other families. Thus, we started Mothers of Murdered Offspring.
And you've been doing this since the early 90s, essentially.
1993.
Okay, and you were described in a recent article in Creative Loafing as being literally tired from all the killing. That was back in April. And the article went on to say that you had held a vigil or a memorial of some sort to honor a different Charlotte area homicide victim on each night of the week leading up to that day.
Yeah, that particular week it was a rough one because we were having them almost every day, and everybody was just going like, "What is going on? You know, what is wrong with people to where they no longer want to talk to each other? All you want to do is pick up a gun and shoot somebody."
You're on the front line, and you talk to families, and you're in the neighborhoods, and you're talking to friends of the victims, and you're talking to friends, I assume, of the murderers in some cases. What is going on from your point of view?
I don't know. I tell you, I'm still trying to figure it out because I wish we all had a crystal ball where we could see where the next crime was going to take place. Because if we did, hey, we'd all stop it. We'd all do everything we could to stop it. But unfortunately, we don't get that privilege of those who are anticipating committing a murder to call us or announce, hey, I'm getting ready to do this. And so all we can do is actually react. But what I can say is that I see that, you know, people just have short fuses. I think it's drugs. I think it's alcohol. I think it's people's lack of just wanting to even talk to other individuals about anything. Everybody's got a short fuse for some reason. It's like a sense of anger all the time or a sense of entitlement. I'm not sure what is fusing all of this. But I just know that it doesn't take much. I mean, in a split second, two people can be in an altercation and one can end up dead.
CMPD Captain Cecil Brisbane told WFAE that people are not working to resolve their problems without resorting to gun violence. They aren't taking the opportunities to de-escalate. And he says that pulling out a gun is final. You don't come back from that.
Right. And I mean, we've been trying to get people at our candlelight services to grasp the concept of forever. How do you make a decision that ends a person's existence forever? Do you know the finality of forever? And I don't think people even think about it. They just want to deal with what they're feeling right then. They're not thinking about the other person. They're not even thinking about their own family. They're not thinking about the other person's family.
But as we've said in this program, talking to Daryl Stevens and Michael Turner, most of these murders around the country are confined to particular communities in cities around the country. So they're the ones that are most often impacted by this. They are a finite number of people who see this happening in their community over and over and over again. They see the pain, the suffering that this causes. So even the people who are most likely to pull the trigger probably have been affected by a previous murder in some way.
And they probably have. And for some reason, at that very moment, they don't even care. I mean, we've been trying to get people, can you think beyond that moment? Can you think beyond the moment of the anger so that you can maybe think about how it's going to impact your life? How it's going to impact your children? How about your wife, your mother, your father, your sisters and brothers? Can you think beyond that moment of anger? And it's like people just don't. Can I tell you real quickly, I had an incident where a lady told me the other day, she said a lady followed her to a Family Dollar store, and the lady got out, you know, ranting and raving at her, and she said, you know, you cut me off. Now, the lady was in the wrong lane, but for some reason, because this lady didn't let her get in front of her, she considered it cutting her off. This lady went to her trunk, and the other lady went under her seat. I mean, they were fixed. These two women didn't even know each other, and they were getting ready to pull out guns. I'm going like, she said, but a police officer undoubtedly had seen the incident and pulled up right behind the other lady, and that stopped it, and she went on about her business. But had he not seen that, this would have been another problem, possibly fatality in Charlotte over somebody just cutting somebody off.
So you, Judy, told WBTV that what politicians can do is push for tougher laws. You said that a lot of these are repeat offenders, and we can make sure they stay in jail a little while longer. Have you gotten any response from politicians, from candidates for political office, for people in office about that comment?
No, I haven't. And I mean, I'm sure that, you know, I
any comment from the judicial system or from law enforcement about that comment?
But I just think that, you know, what the question was asked to me, did I think that this should become an election issue? And my response was no, because these people cannot do anything to stop violence. But what they can do is use the power that they do have to make laws as stiff as possible so that people who have just made up their mind they're not going to abide by our laws, that they stay in jail as long as possible, because a lot of it is repeat offenders. They can go and spend 10 years in jail and come out and do the same thing. So, you know, I that's the only solution. I don't know what else we can do, because we don't get the precursors of when these are going to happen. All we can do is take the people out who continue to break the law, because a lot of the people who the average Joe citizen, you know, they don't go out deliberately to break the law. A lot of the people, these people have made up their minds, you know, I'm going to do what I want to do, and nobody's going to stop me. And as they keep coming back before into the judicial system, something has got to do to let them know, no, you cannot do what you want to do. You've got to learn to live by the laws of this land. You've got to learn to get along with your neighbor. You can't just live like you're an island unto yourself. I mean, you got to do that, because I don't know what other solution there is.
Judy Williams is co-founder of Mothers of Murdered Offspring. She's here along with Daryl Stevens, executive director of Major Cities Chiefs Association. It's an organization of law enforcement officers from around the country. Dr. Michael Turner is also with us by phone, professor and chair of the Department of Criminal Justice and Criminology at UNC Charlotte. Judy, stay with us and be part of this conversation, if you would, please. Daryl Stevens, we were talking with Judy just a second ago about repeat offenders. Mm-hmm. And this is a constant problem, it seems to me, not just here, around the country. Why are repeat offenders on the streets?
Well, it's partly the sentencing practices, but there's been effort to reform sentencing to make it more appropriate. But I think the key figure, and by the way, Mrs. Williams has made enormous contributions to our community going back a lot of years, but the key is what happens to someone when they leave prison and return to home. Mm-hmm. What kind of services are they to help them make that transition? And I think that's why you see the continual repeat offender cycle.
Yeah.
They've no hope, no opportunities, no help to speak of, and so they go back out on the street, they get a gun, and engage in the same activity.
And Dr. Turner, it seems to me there's a big series of articles this week in the Charlotte Observer about the North Carolina prison system. People think of prison as punishment. Would we be wiser to think and concentrate more on rehabilitation as opposed to just punishment?
Well, I would include, in addition to rehabilitation, the reentry services that Daryl was just talking about. That needs to be a priority to individuals, particularly those individuals who spend a substantial period of time in prison. I think as Judy was saying there, and she's exactly right, which is when these individuals, they are not seeing consequences and they are not caring about the consequences. But if you think about it, you're putting that in your frame of life where you have things to lose. If you have nothing to lose, no job, no family, no other opportunities to live a law-abiding society and dig yourself out of that deep, deep hole, I could see why individuals solve problems the way they do, right? I mean, they have nothing to lose, so they're not worried about the consequences because they don't have any consequence. They don't have any loss, right, that the rest of us do.
There seems to be another problem here. Because these murders are fundamentally confined to these particular areas of cities around the country where economic prospects are bleak and where you say, as you just said, a lot of people, there's no way out. Nothing's going to happen as a result of this. So, and most people in the community don't see this. They don't see the conditions that lead to this, and they're not impacted by it. How do you get the rest of the community to care?
That's a huge question, and one that every urban center in the country, every police department works on continually. It is hard to get people to care. It's not that they don't care; they just don't have time for it because it doesn't affect them personally. But that's where I think government leaders come in. That's where your city councils and your state legislatures.
How do you get them to care? Because one of our big problems in this city is upward mobility, social mobility, the ability to rise in stature as you work. Affordable housing is a consistent problem in Charlotte. There's not enough of it. How do you get the politicians to care?
Well, the only thing that we can do, continue to do, is to make sure that they have a clear understanding of what the problems are.
Don't they?
I'm not so sure they do.
Really?
I think they have their concept of what the problems are. And what we've seen for quite a number of years is the solution is just to lock more people up. That takes care of the problem for a short period of time, but they always come back home. And you're not dealing with the pipeline that pushes them into that system.
Judy Williams, I know that you deal with political people all the time, office holders all the time. Do they not understand the problem?
I think it's overwhelming because it's so much. It's just so much. And it's not that I don't think they understand it. It's like, what's going to work? What's going to help? And they don't have all of the clear-cut answers as to what's going to work right away that's going to help people and satisfy the citizens of Charlotte that are not caught up in it as of yet. So, you know, because I think eventually it'll knock on a lot of doors, and it doesn't have to necessarily be in a certain economic area or group of people, because, I mean, violence eventually just spreads. And if you don't get a handle on it, it affects people who you think. I mean, when you hear people on TV say things like, well, I'm just shocked that this happened in this area. Oh, it'll get there eventually. So, you know, I think they know what's going on, and I think they want to do something about it, but just the clear lines of how you do it, you know, gets a little foggy because, you know, you may try this and say, well, that didn't work. Well, let's try this. No, that didn't work. So it's just finding solutions, and many of them, because one solution is not going to solve all our problems.
CMPD says it's doing everything it can to get a handle on this rising homicide rate. One of the things they're doing is focusing on repeat offenders. They're also seizing guns. These guns, I take it, are illegally possessed guns that were bought through back channels for the most part, but I guess some of them could be legally possessed firearms. But isn't that kind of like playing whack-a-mole? The guns are so readily available, you see some guns, more just pop up, don't they?
It is to some extent, but it is the people on the streets carrying the guns that end up using them for violent purposes. And in places where we have seen prosecution of offenders, gun offenders, that helps to some extent. Doesn't solve the long-term problem. It's more of a symptom, but it does help have an impact on those numbers.
Police are also involved in other efforts to reduce violence, particularly gun violence. And after our last conversation back in March, CMPD held a youth violence prevention conference. I believe, I know that you were part of this, right, Daryl? Were you part of this, Michael?
That is correct.
Okay, yes. So the question raised by that conference was, why is violence in America on the rise, and what must Charlotte do? What, if any, answers emerged? Dr. Turner.
Mike, I think if answers and predictions and explanations could be had, I think we'd all be some very wealthy people. I think we have a hard time explaining why we had a 20-year decrease. I think criminologists don't even agree on that. So to explain what solutions that we're going to put in place to solve the problems and know that they're going to solve problems, if we could do that now, I think we'd be very, very prominent people. But we just don't have that ability to do that, and we shouldn't act like we should.
What did you take away from the conference?
Well, I heard the same issues that we've talked about for violence for many, many years. The poverty, the unemployment, education, everyone recognizes that that's what contributes to a young man or a young woman growing up and involving themselves in a life of crime. What we haven't been able to do is to have the persistence, the long-term commitment to working through these problems over a number of years. We're at it for a year, and then we go away.
Daryl Stevens is former chief at CMPD, executive director now of the Major Cities Chiefs Association. Dr. Michael Turner is professor and chair of the Department of Criminal Justice and Criminology at UNC Charlotte. And Judy Williams is co-founder of Mothers of Murdered Offspring. We'll be having a public conversation about this in the very near future. That will include Chief Kerr Putney as well. Thank you all for the hour.
Thank you.